Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, in 1839, rumors of an extraordinary yet baffling bunch of stone ruins buried within the unmapped jungles of Central America sent two of the world's most intrepid explorers on an unforgettable journey. What they found rewrote our understanding of human history. And coming up around 12:35 today, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize finalist and journalist William Carlson. He joins us to share insights from his new book, Jungle of Stone, The True Story of Two Men, Their Extraordinary Journey, and the Discovery of the Lost Civilization of the Maya. Interesting story, and William Carlson actually retraced that journey himself, so we'll hear from him later. First, I'm very pleased to welcome back someone who's written an historical story of a different kind. Hazel Gaynor is the New York Times bestselling author of The Girl Who Came Home and A Memory of Violets. And she's been very well recognized. She was the recipient of the 2012 Cecil Day Lewis Award for Emerging Writers. She was a guest speaker at Romantic Novelist Association and Historical Novel Society annual conferences in 2014. She also won the RNA Historical Romantic Novel of the Year Award in 2015. And she's back today with her new book. It's called The Girl from the Savoy. Hazel Gaynor, welcome.
Hi, Vicki. Lovely to be here.
And I'm very pleased to have you here again in our lovely, beautiful Emerald City. And you're, of course, joining us from Ireland, which we call the Emerald Isle.
Absolutely.
So this book, before I forget, I should mention it does not come out until tomorrow. It's launching tomorrow. So that's really exciting. And we're glad to have you here today.
That's right. Yeah. Sort of publication eve here for me in Ireland. So really always a really exciting time to finally see the book out on the shelves and getting it into readers' hands. So really exciting.
Yeah. Right. So apart from writing this book and winning more awards on your other books, what's been going on with you the past year since we talked?
Well, it's been busy, in a word. Yeah, so it's all really happened quite quickly. I mean, it's the third year. My first book, The Girl Who Came Home, was published in 2014 with A Memory of Violet just less than a year after. And then this, The Girl from the Savoy, another year on. So really busy time, because obviously with my third book, I still do have promotional work to do with the other two books. So you realise that you have to juggle quite a lot. It's quite different, quite a different experience from writing your debut novel.
Right.
And obviously now, because this book, The Girl from the Savoy, is just coming out, I'm already well underway with my next project. So lots of balls in the air, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that is good, and it stops. You know, if one starts getting a little tedious, you can just move on to the next thing, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny though, because people then start to say, "Oh, which is your favorite? You know, you must have a favorite book or favorite character or favorite cover." And I say, "Absolutely, you couldn't. It's like being asked to choose your favorite child. It's an impossible question. You know, they all have their unique qualities and merits." So it's lovely to actually have a catalogue of books now. It's lovely for readers, if they discover one of the books, they can go and read the other and then sort of build up a familiarity with me, which is really nice.
That's right. I remember actually last time you referred to your books, your collection of books as they're coming along, as a family of books. So of course you can't choose between them.
No, absolutely. Couldn't possibly. What a horrendous decision to have to make. Yeah. I'm very proud of them all. Isn't that what we say?
Yes. So. So in your first book, you tackled the Titanic, which, of course, is a giant topic. And people said to you, are you crazy? But that was a New York Times bestseller. In the second book, Memory of Violets, you explored the relationship between sisters. You had parallel timelines. And I remember you talking about trying to capture the sensory aspects of that, because it took place a lot in the flower markets. With this book, The Girl from the Savoy, tell us first of all where the idea for this particular story came from.
So yeah, this is quite a different in terms of inspiration and approach, I guess. So really this started with a love of the era. As you say, I had written about an iconic event, a world that I wanted to explore more in Victorian London in the market. With the Girls from the Savoy, it was really a fascination with this roaring 20s, this endlessly glamorous era that we see depicted very often in films. Obviously, we all fell in love with Downton Abbey, which was set during that period as well. And for me, what I wanted to really explore was particularly how those years felt, having just come out of the awful experience of war. And obviously, the experiences of war are really, I believe, what led to people living this exuberant lifestyle, because they could all of a sudden, they had freedoms again, and they things settled down after all the awful uncertainty of war. And particularly for women, women had been in all sorts of situations they would never have been in before. The very social elite had been in horrific conditions out in the field hospitals as nurses, and ordinary working class girls who would have worked in a domestic capacity had experience working, making bombs as munitionettes in the factories and in offices as clerks. So everybody came out of this really having shifted their foundations of what they knew life to be. And for me, that's a fantastic premise for story, because everything's changing and there's no sort of rules anymore. So I was really drawn to that particular time frame. So I do touch on the period during the war. One of my characters is a soldier recovering from shell shock, and just how an ordinary working class girl and somebody at the opposite end of the social spectrum, how they deal with the aftermath of war and how that has affected them.
Right. And I do think that's a very interesting period of time. I was watching a documentary a few weeks ago, and they said that up until now, of course, with the technological boom of change that we've faced over the last decade or so, but up until now, that particular time was a time when we did see the most societal change, because, what was very well accepted before the war was not so well accepted after the war, and yet other things did become accepted after the war. One of the things you talk about in there is, let's first of all talk about your protagonist here. Her name is Dorothy Lane. She goes by Dolly, and she's this dreamer. Tell us a little bit more about Dolly, because she's quite an adorable character.
Yeah, Dolly, I really hope people will root for her. She's I've hopefully written her as a very gutsy, sort of misplaced ambition, really, I suppose. She is an ordinary working class Lancashire lass who really would have expected very little from life, but has had this sense of wanting something more. And that's where I think it's interesting that through the experience of war has maybe sort of broken out of what would have been her expected path in life. We meet her just as she's about to start a new position as a chambermaid at the Savoy Hotel in London. And for me, the appeal of setting the story in one of these grand, iconic hotels from the era was just how much opportunity there was for people to come and go in that setting. And obviously, the chambermaid, young Dolly, would walk into these sumptuous suites with the very rich and famous who stayed at the Savoy. And, they had impressive guests. They had Fred and Adele Astaire. They had Tallulah Bankhead, all these iconic actresses and people from the time. And Dolly would have been in there rearranging their clothing, sorting out their jewellery, cleaning the nightstand. And I just thought, what a fascinating situation for her to be in. So she really has always longed for more, and she loved going to the theatre. And when I was researching the book, I found this really lovely name of a group of girls, these really poorer in society, if you like, who would pay all of the money they had to go to the theatre and sit in the cheap seats at the top in the gallery, and they were known as the gallery girls. And they would get quite hysterical because they absolutely adored certain actors and actors, and they would shout the house down, if a performance was particularly good or bad. I think it would have been an amazing experience to be in the theatre. So Dolly has seen people on the stage, and she just wants to dance and sing. So we follow her journey as she tries to break out of her expected situation. situation in life and become something more.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about celebrity around that time, because it was very different to celebrity now. And I do remember my grandmother, who would have, you know, she was born in 1890. I do remember her saying that when she was a young woman, actresses weren't looked upon very favorably.
Yes, there was certainly a certain class of actress, shall we say, and it was more the movie actresses that were considered to be, let's say, less respected than the theatre actresses. And there were certain pockets. So you did have the Gaiety Girls and Cochrane's Young Ladies, who came out of the Edwardian era, and they would have been very well respected chorus lines. And they were, you know, often populated by quite well-to-do ladies in society. So it was very far removed from, you know, the bawdy burlesque kind of shows that people would have also gone to for entertainment. So an actress on the stage was perceived quite differently to an actress in the silent movies, or the talkies, as they were just starting to be. So certainly, there was a level of respect, but it was still, people certainly, this is my character Loretta, who is an actress and has come from very good stock, and her parents are quite disappointed that she has found herself on the stage, because it wouldn't be the most acceptable profession for your young lady to go into. So she's a rebel. She's completely rebelled against her own parents and what society would have expected of her as a lady. But several of them did it. Yeah, they did. They married very well-to-do men who courted them at the stage door. So, yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, and one of those characters was actually a real person, Alice. I think she was a French actress, if I remember rightly. Yeah. Why did you choose to put her in there?
Well, Alice Delicia, I just through my research, so, you know, I came across lots of the more well-known names like Tallulah Bankhead and Gertrude Lawrence and Vinnie Hale, and I found lots of records in one of the scrapbooks I was researching in a museum in London, and I was looking through the actual first night notices and critical reviews of various performances, and there was a whole series about this French actress, Alice Delicia, who was first spotted on the stage in Paris, and one of the big theatrical producers of the time, called Charles Cochrane, he brought her over to London, and he sort of mentored her. He saw potential. He was really, really good at spotting raw talent at the time, and actually was responsible for the careers of lots and lots of actresses at that time. And I just found her quite an interesting character. She was a less well-known name to me. So she has a little cameo. She comes to the Savoy, and Dolly starts to work for her in some capacity. So it was just really interesting to find those incredible lost records of these real iconic women of the time who were idolized by these ordinary working class girls. I mean, as you say, celebrity, you think maybe now, you know, we see sort of hysterical red carpet premieres. But I think the gallery girls in the 20s would have given people now a run for their money. There was lots of talk of them running up the theatre steps and losing shoes and hats and gloves in the frenzy to get to the best seats. So it must have been something to see.
Right. Well, it was so novel as well. You know, it was something really different. We're going to take a very quick break. When I come back, I want to talk a little bit about some of the music you listen to while you're writing this book. Because a lot of this my dad would sing to me when I was a kid. The book is called The Girl from the Savoy. It's by New York Times bestselling author of The Girl Who Came Home, Hazel Gaynor. And we will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Savoy, the home of sweet romance. Savoy, it wins you at a glance. Savoy gives happy feet a chance to dance.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-4000. 6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, psychiatrist Dr. Graham Brenner on how best to help a distraught friend through a breakup. And Dr. Stephanie Fobian of the Mayo Clinic shares the latest advice on turning menopause into a positive, individualized experience. In The Menopause Solution, a doctor's guide to relieving hot flashes, enjoying better sex, sleeping well, controlling your weight, and being happy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. And find more than 400 podcasts on conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and I'm very pleased to be talking for the third time with Hazel Gaynor. We've talked with her at the release of each of her books. This new book comes out tomorrow. It's called The Girl from the Savoy. And Hazel, in the book, I love at the back, you put these little tidbits in there behind the scenes. You talk about some of your research and stuff like that. And one of the things you included this time was a playlist of the music that you listen to. And of course, this is a period piece, and so you listen to period piece music.
Yeah.
But my family were huge on music. Music played in everybody's house when we were growing up. And my dad loved to sing, and my grandfather loved to sing, and my grandmother loved to sing. So I was very familiar with some of these songs that you put in here. Talk to us about the music you listened to and how it inspired you, because I think it can be a very powerful influence to us.
Yeah, well, I absolutely, you know, for me, music, I find it very evocative. It can trigger memories of being somewhere at a certain time. And I, part of my research is obviously trying to inhabit the era that I'm writing in for a period of time. So for me, music really helped me to feel what it would have been like to be there. And one of my characters in the book, Perry, he is a struggling musical composer. So from his point of view as well, I really had to feel I understood the type of music that was being written for the theatre and that was being played in the nightclubs and in the dance hall, because obviously in the Savoy Hotel, people would go for a dinner dance and they had a resident hotel band, the Savoy Orpheans. So a few Google searches led me to these fabulous, scratchy old gramophone records, recordings of the Savoy Orpheans playing and recording live at the Savoy Hotel in 1923 when the book is set. It's so romantic and nostalgic, and it really just, for me, it was important, as I say, to feel that I was there, and I've referenced the music quite a lot through Perry and Dolly and their relationship and how she helped him to have inspiration for his
music. Right.
So I find it very, very moving to listen to music, and also it's great fun. You know, you listen to these sort of warbling old voices, and this is when jazz was really just starting to happen, so just, you can't help but try and have a bit of a Charleston whilst you're listening to that. You know, it's great fun.
It was happy music. I remember every single car ride we took, my dad would sing one of them you have on your list here, "If You Were the Only Girl in the World and I Were the Only Boy."
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah, they are. They're fantastic. And people were so, I just think the way people sang then was so different. So it just, it partly makes me laugh and smile. And it just makes me want to get up and dance, although I can't dance very well, but I'll try.
Yeah, I did enjoy reading that. And one of the things that, you know, soon after Dolly gets to the Savoy and she becomes a chambermaid there, she answers an ad, or she responds to a struggling songwriter's ad for a muse. And I'm wondering, as a writer, do you believe in the muse?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because, so Dolly does. She sees this advert for a muse wanted. Doesn't quite know what that means, but she responds anyway, and this leads to all this exciting things that happen to her. But I think the thing with being a writer is I don't think you can sit down and wait for your muse to show up if you do have such a thing. I think it's partly about just sitting down and writing regardless.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I do think there's definitely something. I think it's just tapping into, you get into a certain space in your head and the words just seem to flow. And for me, that's when my muse has arrived. I don't sort of give that any physical embodiment or anything. But I think you have to write regardless. I think that's the thing I would say, that if they show up, brilliant. But if not, just try anyway.
Right. And so while we're talking about writing itself, I understand you had a lot of help from Puffin the Cat.
Yes. So that, she's probably my muse, actually, in fairness. So I write, I have two young children, they're at primary school. So when they're at school, I come up to the attic at the top of the house and that's where I write. And my cat always comes and sits beside me and looks at me forlornly. And I had my plot laid out on sticky post-it notes, and she had rolled over them and moved some of them around, and actually when I looked at where they'd landed, it made a lot more sense. I left it as it was, so I do have to give her some credit for that. Yeah.
So I know
all writers have a cat, don't they? Lots of writers have cats. There's definitely an affinity there.
Yes, I have a dog, but he'll do his little trick, like if he thinks I've been there too long, he'll come up and grab the sleeve of my whatever I'm wearing very gently and twizzle my chair around so I'm not looking at the computer anymore.
Yes. Very not very subtle hints.
Yeah.
I did a live radio interview this morning and she was meowing, so I'm sure that went out on air.
So, you know, I know that you enjoy research and you put a great deal of effort into making these stories as authentic as possible. At what point do you know when you've got enough research? Do you write as you go along, gathering your research? Do you gather your research based on what you're writing? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, research for me, it's a really important part of this. What I tend to do once I've had the initial idea is I'll read very widely, so I'll sort of do a very broad search for example, iconic hotels in London in the 1920s, theatre in London in the 1920s, key events happening at the time. So you've got a sense of what had just happened before this period and what's happening now, what's important to people. And then from there you start to see things that draw your attention. So you think, oh, that sounds interesting, and I contacted a couple of the hotels, and an archivist at the Savoy was incredibly helpful. So that sort of narrowed me down to the Savoy. Went and found this amazing archive of theatre reviews. From that, sort of honed in on what my actress was going to do. So it's a great question, because I think I do love that part of the job, but there's a point where you have to stop researching and start writing the book, because ultimately this is about a story and it has to have character and emotion and that narrative arc. It's not a history lesson. So that I do that first body, so I get a sense of where I'm going, and then I'll continue to research to drill down into specific details as I get to that point in the book or to that character. So,
right.
And it can get really specific. I mean, I was obsessing about floor coverings in hotels for a period of time to find out what would Dolly have been walking on. Would it have been carpet or wood or lino, as it turned out to be? So sometimes lots of what I find out actually never ends up in the book, because it's just for me to feel confident about representing the era authentically.
Right.
But I love it. Absolutely. It's a great part of the process. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you do evoke that sense of emotion, because I felt immediately I started reading this that I was right there. And even though this didn't happen in the same time frame, because I'm not that old, but it evoked a memory so strong in me of my one of my grandmothers used to like to shop at Marshall and Snellgrove, which was like the uppity store of its time. And I always remember, I mean, I was only about five, because I was 5 years old when she left England. But I was only five, and I do remember like the carpets that we walked on. And I remember the guy in the elevator with his uniform and his little tip jar. And like, it just evoked such strong memories. So that came from your writing. You have at the back of the book a discussion group question. So I'm going to throw a couple of those questions back to you really quickly here.
Okay.
So Dolly's position as a chambermaid gives her access to the less well-known side of iconic hotels like the Savoy. What did you enjoy about the chapters where we go behind the scenes at the hotel? What did you particularly enjoy, Hazel?
Oh, I just loved the idea of these girls gossiping in their room at night and actually hearing. I imagined that if they had an open window, they could maybe hear this amazing music going on downstairs, and that would, you know, how could that not affect you? And just gossiping about what they'd seen in the rooms they'd been cleaning. So I absolutely loved that idea of this group of girls working hard but having sort of fun at the same time because of where they were.
Right, right.
So really, yeah, I liked that.
Right. And then, so what did you enjoy most about this period? Or maybe what surprised you most about this period since you were researching and writing this?
Yeah, do you know, I think what I hadn't appreciated, because we do obviously hear a lot about the roaring 20s, and it is all fantastic clothes, the hats, the shoes, the music, the, you know, the cars. But what we forget was there were so many people still struggling to come to terms with what had happened during the war. You know, obviously lots of women faced a life of being a single woman because there were no men for them to marry. You know, people had been utterly devastated. I just think that dynamic, we often forget that the one led to the other. So there was this sense of we just have to, you know, get on with things now. And that's why people did push the boundaries, I think, which allowed it to become the Roaring Twenties. So, yeah, that research about the late years of the war and how it affected people really surprised me, yeah.
Mm. Well, it's a great book, great writer. Hazel Gaynor, the book is called The Girl from the Savoy. Listeners can find out more about Hazel Gaynor at hazelgaynor.com. A final thought, Hazel, you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I'm just always very excited to know that tomorrow is the big day. So I really hope people will enjoy the book and that it will just transport them somewhere else. You know, reading to me is a very precious time. You forget about real life and all of the stresses and hassles and just drift away to some beautiful romantic era that's long forgotten, and just enjoy living through my characters. I just hope that that's what the books do for people.
Yeah, well, I wish you all the best with this. I know you've had great success with your other two books, and I think this is going to be even bigger and better.
Oh, it's really kind of you to say, and it was really good fun chatting to you. It's great to hear that you knew all the music as well.
Yeah, well, again, you can find out more about Hazel and her work, Hazel Gaynor, at hazelgaynor.com. And this book is called The Girl from the Savoy, and it's available tomorrow. All right, stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by William Carlson. We'll be taking a historic journey of a different kind in the jungle of stone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Who's wonderful? Who's marvelous? Miss Annabelle Lee. Who's kissable? Who's lovable? Miss Annabelle Lee. Ain't she a pretty baby? What would you give? Oh, West Calling her. Sir, forget that she's exclusive. Who's dignified? Who's glorified?
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
You're listening to the refreshingly different Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're all about historical stories today, but this one has a modern twist to it. This is an actual true story. My guest is William Carlson. He was a reporter for 2 decades at the San Francisco Chronicle, where he was a finalist for the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. He's also worked for the New York Times and taught journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. And he's written an awesome new book. It's called Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. Welcome, William Carlson. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, this is such a great book. It's the kind of book you could get lost in for many days and then go back and get lost some more in there. So what was it, I guess, that sparked this interest in this particular story for you? Because this book is based, we should let listeners know what the book's about, first of all. It's based on a true story, but you also followed that journey yourself. So tell us in your own words, if you would.
Yes, my wife and I lived on and off in Guatemala for many years, and I had an interest in the Maya because we, from time to time, would go to some of the ruins in Guatemala and Honduras. And one day, a good friend of ours stopped by when we were living down there and gave me a book by an author named John L. Stevens, and it was about his journey and discovery of the Mayan civilization with another man by the name of Frederick Catherwood. And I was just enthralled by the writing and by the illustrations, and it gave me this great sense of not only the Maya, but the wonder of discovery that they had conveyed in the book and in the illustrations. And so I decided to travel the 2,500-mile journey that they took in 1839-1840. It was kind of funny because they went on mules. That was the transport of the time. And I didn't have a mule. But I had a 1985 Toyota Corolla, and without air conditioning, without the radio, and the closest thing I could come, actually, to a mule. And so I set out to follow their entire path. Took me 3 months, and it was a great adventure. Went to all the ruins that they had discovered. They had discovered something like 44-plus ancient Mayan cities in the jungle. And then when I came back to San Francisco, I was teaching journalism at Berkeley, and I discovered that John L. Stevens' papers were at the library at the University of California. And so I went over and started reading through his letters and his papers, and, well, that was it. I mean, I had to do their story. There was no question about it. So
right.
I wanted to dig into the background of both men, and so that's how it came about.
Yeah. So let's look at how they became interested in this journey, because back then, I mean, there were no roads paved. They literally were going through jungle. And, I mean, what was it that sparked their interest? Such interesting characters. There's so much to talk about on this.
Right. Well, they were interesting men. Stevens was a lawyer from New York, and Catherwood was an architect illustrator from London. And they had both gone through the Middle East separately, about 5 years apart, But they had both been to Egypt and to the Sinai, through the Sinai Desert. Stevens was the first American, one of the first Westerners to actually enter the ruins at Petra, which is in southern Jordan, and the holy city, Jerusalem. So they were, you know, in the desert, they had picked up some kind of bug. I mean, it's almost this virus of exploration and discovery. They were so thrilled with the ruins along the Nile, and then they met up in New York. And they Stevens had written a couple of books about his travels through the Middle East, and Catherwood had developed a what was called a roundabout or a panorama, where he set up all his illustrations of the ruins along the Nile and Jerusalem, and you would stand in the middle and turn 360 degrees. This was before photography and before film and video. And anyway, they met up because they had this these similar interests. And so they heard about these stones that had been found in the jungle in Central America that seemed to indicate there might be something like ancient cities down there. There had been some a couple of reports. And so they just couldn't help themselves. You know, they just had to go down and find out for themselves. Unfortunately, it was in the middle of a very vicious civil war that was going on at the time. And Stevens, to get cover, he had political connections in New York, and he managed to get the president at that time, Martin Van Buren, to appoint him the diplomat to Central America as kind of a cover. But it didn't last long. I mean, within 2 months, they were taken hostage at gunpoint and incredible adventures. It was amazing
right. What
they did, really.
Right. When I was looking through the book and looking at some of the illustrations, I thought, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, this is surely where they got this story from.
Well, you know, a book reviewer here in the United States had written that their adventures make Indiana Jones look like a stay-at-home slacker.
Yes.
And I think that's a fair thing to say. I mean, they endured incredible hardship. You know, there were no paths, as you say. Mosquitoes, unbearable heat. I went at the same time of year that they had gone because I wanted to experience what they had experienced in the way of the heat and the humidity and so on. And mosquitoes, they had bout after bout of malaria. There was great danger with the war going on, swirling around them. So, it's you know, it's a great adventure tale, but it's also a serious book of history and discovery. And anyone that is interested in history and the evolution of civilization, I think, would find it very interesting on that level as well.
Right, right. Well, you say in the book that on many levels they were absolutely matched, that, you know, such an odd couple to travel together, but they made the perfect couple, really, because, you know, Stevens was such a great wordsmith. Catherwood was the illustration. The illustrations are just beautiful. And Edgar Allan Poe, I read, called it perhaps the most interesting book of travel ever published. It became a bestseller, and it's still recognized today as, I think I read somewhere, it's still printed today, or
it's
in print.
Still in print, yeah. Their books are still in print. All these 170 years, I should wish for my book. They're brilliant books. They're brilliant books. And, of course, I tell their story as they told it, but, I mean, on a kind of a moment-to-moment basis, I mean, going with them. And, of course, I fill in a lot from my own experience of traveling their route. But also I go into the biography of each man, and I take them right to the end of their lives. And there was a British expedition that was kind of competing with them, so I put that in there. And the important thing was to put it in the context of the times, because in the early 19th century, you know, a lot of the world was not even discovered yet. Antarctica wasn't discovered yet. Central Africa was still basically undiscovered, except for the people, of course, who were living there.
Right.
But and so I try to put it in that context, like with Lewis and Clark's expedition and things like that. So I worked on several levels. They were an interesting couple, because Stevens was very kind of small and very intense, very, very gregarious. And Stevens was very, very reserved in that British way, very private. And yet they had this perfect match of writing and illustrating, because this was before the time of geography. And if you were to go down there and discover something like a civilization and you brought it back in words, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, to see it, to see the monuments and see the pyramids and see all that was very important to their story.
Yes, yes. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you some specifics about your journey and some specifics about their journey. It's such a fascinating story. And my guest is William Carlson. His book is Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. You're listening to Conversations Live. We'll be right back.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking in this segment with journalist William Carlson. He's the author of Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. And we were talking in the break, William, and we ran out of time, so I want to just continue that a little, because I'd mentioned to you how severe John Lloyd Stevens looked in the image of him in the book. So tell us, you were going to tell me something about that.
Well, he was a very intense man, nervous and very intense, and great storyteller, obviously, not only in his book, but he's a raconteur, you know. But he Herman Melville saw him when he was a child, when Melville was a child, and met him with his mother. Melville and his mother were in a church in New York City, and he never forgot Stevens, the look on, he said he had these burning eyes, this intense burning expression, you know,
yes.
And it does come across in that particular daguerreotype. Actually, that was before photography, but it was to get that image.
Yes, it definitely does. And then the, going on to the next image that's next to that in the book, there's an image of Frederick Heatherwood, and you say that although he was known to many artists during his lifetime, no other depictions of him have been found, just that one image.
Right. Well, he was a mysterious guy. He, because he was so quiet and unassuming and private, he did have many, many friends among artists and writers in New York City and in London. Nonetheless, couldn't find any images of him. They just don't exist. And the image that I had to use in the book was a image of a kind of a blow-up of an image that he drew of himself in one of the ruins, a place called Tulum, which many people today know about because it's right near the tourist sites in, near Cancun, and millions of people go to the ruins in Chichen Itza and Tulum because they're short bus rides from all of the resorts near Cancun. But at that time, of course, they were covered in jungle. Right. And there's this image that he drew of himself standing in front of the ruins, one of the ruins, measuring it with Stephen. And he really just used his image and Stephen's image to give you a perspective of the size of the ruins. And so that's the only image we have. And it's very, you know, very indistinct, very almost blurry because we blew it up. But that's it. That's the only image of it's ironic. I mean, here's a man who did so much artwork and so much illustration of his own, and yet none of it of him exists.
Right. Obviously, he preferred to do it than be the subject
right.
of.
Right. Exactly.
So we mentioned earlier that you chose to follow their journey, and I didn't know until we were chatting in the break that at that time you didn't really weren't sure you were going to write a book about it, but you wanted to take the journey there. You chose to land the same week that they had landed 170 years earlier. You went to the village of Isabel, I think it was,
right.
To see where they came ashore. And I believe back then it was when they went, it was more populated than when you arrived. Is that correct, or am I confusing
that's
with another part of the story?
It was the major port of entry for Central America on the Atlantic side. And it was an old Spanish town. It only had 5,000 or 6,000 people at that time. When I went there, there probably were a couple hundred people that lived there because the port had then been moved to a different location that was much more accessible to the Caribbean. So at the time they came, that was the major port of entry. And from there, you had to go over this mountain. They were on their way to Guatemala City, where he had to do his diplomatic duties 120 miles inland.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, it was just a bunch of small huts with palm thatched roofs, and there wasn't much there.
Right, right. And so, as you said before, you drove in a Toyota, took the same journey. They took it by mule, but perhaps one of the most significant differences is what the vision that we'd had in our head, because you've had access to all of this history and the research and the books and everything. They did not know what they were going to. It was just based on rumor, as I understand it, when they went. And they really did, their findings really did tip upside down what we thought about things. A couple of examples. Back then, most Christians believed the world was only 6,000 years old. Their discoveries, you know, proved that to be wrong. They found remains of in the Mayan civilization. We learned that they had actual writing tools, an actual system of writing, the only true form of writing. So there were lots of things that they found which nobody thought existed at that time. So can we talk about some of those? Because there were very many of them.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, to me, one of the most interesting things about it, doing a book like this, was at a moment of discovery in time, in a historical moment, what was known before and then what came to be known after as a consequence of the discovery. I mean, I think a famous thing is of Galileo, you know, discovering that the sun didn't go around the earth, but the earth went around the sun. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. changed. We've never been the same since. I mean, it's Now, they're not on that level, but before they had made their journey, it was thought that if there were any ruins of any indications of a civilization, and there were some of these ruins had been reported, it was believed that these had to be the vestiges of the old world. In other words, these were colonizers maybe 1,000 years before by some Egyptians or Phoenicians that drifted across the Atlantic. The prevailing theory was that was the lost tribes of Israel. But they could not believe in America and the Westerners and in Europe that the primitive, what they thought were primitive, unrefined Native Americans were capable of producing a civilization that turned out to be as extraordinary, you know, as the Mayan civilization is. And so they were the first to prove, in fact, that this civilization that they were uncovering, and they did find 40-plus cities, was created by the Native Americans, and it changed the entire view then of the history of the Americas. And I must say something about the Maya, because it's in the book as well. The Mayan civilization was an extraordinary civilization, one of the most extraordinary civilizations. The Egyptian civilization went back further, but the Mayan civilization lasted 1,700 years, from 800 BC to 900 AD. And they created these monumental pyramids, palaces, temples, incredible architecture, painting, and artwork of extraordinary brilliance. They created the only written language, as you pointed out, hieroglyphic language that can be read now. They finally broke the Maya code. Now we know about all the different dynasties mm-hmm. of each city was a city-state, like the Greeks in Athens and Sparta and so on. And they fought with each other. And so, you know, their discovery was very, very consequential.
And so what surprised you the most when you were doing your research? Because I'm sure you had a lot of aha moments and, like, you know, moments where you thought, wow, I just didn't realize this had happened.
Well, that's a good question. I think it was the discovery for myself of just the thing I was talking about. That as we go through life as a society, you know, we're at a moment where all our beliefs are set from the past, and there's still discoveries to be made. Mm-hmm. And what will they be, and how will we change because of those? That was part of the writing of the book was very important to me to come to that realization that, in fact, there is there are moments in time. I mean, other people, Newton and Einstein, these are people who have made discoveries, and I'm fascinated now, of course, about discoveries.
Yes.
Certainly about civilization.
Yes.
But, yes, that was a very important thing for me.
Well, I've got a ton more questions, but we have no time left, so I'm very disappointed about that, because I've got a ton more questions. But anyway, I really enjoyed talking with you, and I wonder what you'd like to leave our listeners with today, a final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Well, I think the most important thing, well, not the most important thing, but one of the things that comes out of the book and it comes out of the Mayan civilization is that they were so successful that by 800 AD, they were too successful. They had outdone themselves, in essence. There were 10 million Maya that lived in a very small place in the center of Central America, and they had gone beyond their agricultural means. They were using up resources at a rapid rate. There were kings on the top and commoners on the bottom. There were rebellions. There were wars between the states over resources, the diminishing resources. And in the end, what happened, what really caused their final collapse was there were regional mini climate change that occurred because they had deforested mm-hmm. all of the jungle. And it caused decades-long severe droughts that, in essence, pushed them over the edge and right. emptied out all their cities.
Right.
And that's something that we can learn from today, I think, and something they had no idea of what was happening to them.
Right.
But we know what happened to them.
Right.
And
well,
so,
I'm sorry, William, I have to interrupt you.
Sure,
we're right at the end. We're running over here, but
sure.
Fascinating story. Jungle of Stone by William Carlson. William Carlson has an E-S-O-N, S-E-N, not S-O-N. And you can find out more about him and his work at williamcarlson.com. Thank you so much for being with us, everyone. We got to run. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well.